Why is meditation peaceful when it starts to happen? Why is it enjoyable? Because you're giving up so much, which is a burden. You're getting a lot of understanding about the difference between dukkha, suffering, and sukha, happiness. People in the world think they know what happiness is and what suffering is. But the Buddha once said that what people in the world say is happiness, the enlightened ones say is suffering. What people in the world say is suffering, the enlightened ones say is happiness. The Buddha said that. It's because you haven't got enough data, enough experience. And this is where you get the data and experience. So even if you don't actually go fully into the jhanas, just right there, the edge, it's an amazing place to develop insight and understanding. Also, anicca, the impermanence, or not constant. I prefer that word, not constant, because we all have heard impermanence before. Not constant means that something which was constant, which was there for a long time, has now disappeared for a long period of time, which is a different aspect of anicca, being like the wobbly up and down, like waves. Waves going up, waves going down. This is a type of anicca, waves going up, waves disappeared, which is a much more powerful experience of impermanence. And you're getting insight into this. So insight meditation will come at any stage of this meditation you're doing. One, when there's an obstacle which comes up, especially that's where you get a lot of insight. And at each stage, you pause, look, especially at the end of the meditation. This is a teaching which I often give at Nolamara, which I haven't given here yet, which I should have given actually in the first talk. At the end of every meditation, pause before you come out of the meditation, see where you are, what you've attained, what degree of peacefulness you have. You'll be surprised very often, even though you think it's a bad meditation, if you look very carefully, you'll see you have gained some degree of peacefulness. The very fact you've been inclining, you've been trying, means you're more peaceful than you were when you started. Especially if it's a very peaceful meditation, ask yourself why, what have I done? So you review the meditation process at the end of every meditation. That reviewing is very important for you to get deep understanding and insight into the process of meditation. So here you are gaining insight into the ways of your mind, especially into the ways of the meditation. You're becoming wise to how meditation works, to what your obstacles are, how to fix them. And if you can do this, this is an insight meditation which will empower your meditation, which will free your life and will be conducive to those powerful insights of anicca, dukkha, anatta. The other main meditation which I like to talk about is the meditation of letting be, letting go, which is one of the other meditations which I do personally, that sometimes instead of trying to watch the breath as your object, instead of taking loving kindness as your object, sometimes I look at my mind and realize the best thing it needs at the moment is just to let things be. Basically, letting be meditation is just the second stage of breath meditation I teach, to silent awareness of the present moment. It has to be silent, because to really let things be means you give no orders, you don't have any complaints. If you really let things be, basically you've got nothing to say, you've got nothing to talk about. Also, letting be, being, happens in the present moment. You're just aware of things as they're appearing right now. And you allow them to come in. You allow them to stay. You allow them to go whenever they want. Letting be meditation is like sitting here. And whoever comes in that door, you just sit here, they can come in. They can stay as long as they like. If it's a terrible demon, you allow them to come in and sit down, they can stay as long as they like. You just are not at all fazed. But if it's the Buddha himself comes in all his glory, you just sit here just the same, completely equanimous. You can come in if you want, you can go whenever you want. It's like letting be meditation, whatever comes into your mind, the beautiful or the gross, you stand back and just let it be, with no reactions at all, quietly observing, silent awareness in the present moment. And that letting be meditation becomes quite powerful, because if breath meditation is not working, metta meditation doesn't work, or you try any other type of meditation and it's not working, just very often it's because you haven't got the foundation correct. And so just do the letting be meditation. You can just sit out in the garden and just let things be. Whatever is happening is okay. Whatever I'm experiencing is fine. No preference, no choice, no good, no bad, no argument, no commentary. Just let things be. And you can have a little bit of a commentary inside, but just the commentary about, no, let be, let things go. And just be with what is. Just a commentary which is on the meditation subject, but not which is about anything else. It becomes so close to silent awareness of the present moment. And again, you use that meditation. I use that meditation if I'm in pain, got a headache or a stomach ache, or whatever else ache I have. The mosquitoes are biting. Just let it be. So don't argue with it. Don't get upset about it. Just watch the feelings in the body as the mosquito sort of pushes its nose into your flesh, and the itch which comes. Just let things be. Or you're laying in bed at night and you can't go to sleep. Just let it be. Or there's a pain which won't go away. Instead of trying to get rid of it, just be with it. Let it be. Don't try running away. It's like a demon has come into the room. You're not going to try and push it away. You're not going to invite it to stay. You're just going to let it be. So this equanimity practice of letting be is one of the other meditations which I do from time to time. Now, people can sometimes ask, when you do these meditations, how do you choose what to do? You can experiment with doing different meditations at different times. Eventually that you'll find the insight of knowing what your mind is like and knowing what your mind needs is the way to find out what type of meditation to do. I've given the simile before, but sometimes it's like you have a piece of wood from the woodyard. You want to make some furniture, like a meditation stool, say. First thing you do is to look at the piece of wood to find out what it needs. If it's a rough piece of wood, it needs to be planed down first of all. And then you take the roughest grade of sandpaper, and then the medium grade, then the fine grade of sandpaper. Then you get out a polishing cloth with some wax or some oil. If you want to coat it with varnish, you use varnish. But if you use a cloth, then it's only at the end, when you've had the finest sandpaper and it's really smooth, you get the cloth out and you polish it up, and it ends up this beautiful, shiny, smooth piece of furniture. But you have to look at the piece of wood first of all. If you get a piece of wood from the woodyard, just freshly sawn, with all of the burrs on it, if you get the polishing cloth out straight away, you're going to ruin a lot of polishing cloths. And you're not going to make that wood smooth at all. you're going too deep, too fast. If you look at your mind and it's really rough and coarse, and you want to go straight on to the Samadhi Nimitta, you're wasting your time. You've got to get the plane and the sandpaper down first of all. But sometimes it is the case. You get a piece of wood from the shop and it's just so smooth already that all you do need is the polishing cloth. Sometimes you may sit down on that cushion and the mind is already just so peaceful. You don't need to go through all the preliminaries. You can go just straight on to the breath, straight on to the beautiful breath, sometimes straight on to a Samadhi Nimitta. So you look at your piece of wood, your mind, and the skillful meditator knows what it needs. If it needs loving kindness, okay, we'll spend a few minutes doing loving kindness meditation. If it needs some letting be meditation because it's quite coarse, just take it out to the garden and let it be. You know by looking at your mind and by recognizing the state of the mind what it needs. This is again similar to the insight practice of meditation. You recognize the problem and you know the solutions. So these are just some types of meditation. There's a whole range of other types of meditation which I could talk about, but there's not time today. Just to sum up those meditations again, I talked about metta meditation. And please do some at this time of the retreat because it's very important and you'll find it will really help the other meditations you do. I talked about some insight meditation, talked about letting be meditation. So hopefully that these ways of practice will help you during the rest of this retreat period. So are there any questions or comments about what I've been talking about? The first question, dear Ajahn, is it possible to get to jhana by doing a mantra? Is it good to do a mantra while doing anapanasati instead of counting? I did actually mention mantra meditations in that talk on different types of meditation objects, but it's a very good opportunity just to give a plug for mantras. Mantras are a group of words you say to yourself over and over again. So instead of having so many different thoughts come up in your mind and go away again and come up again, instead of having like a diversity of chatter, you just have one chatter. You know, just repeat it over and over again. Whether that's like the traditional one in Northeast Thailand of Buddho, which is, you can try that mantra if you like, if you haven't done yet. Because one thing with like changing just the objects of meditation around a little bit, that it gives a variety to the mind, and the mind likes to do things which are new. You're aiming in the right direction, in the same direction all the time, so you're not really doing anything new at all, you're just continuing on the old practice of calming the mind, developing deep meditation. But just by taking a different object, giving the practice a different flavour, it's the same exactly cake, it's just a different flavour. It just makes it a bit more interesting, and sometimes you find success. So a mantra is a group of words you say over and over to yourself, but the mantra has to be something which resonates with you, which, you know, you feels like interesting, feels good, you feel good about it. I just gave to someone the other day just the mantra of like emptiness or sunyata, because that can be just a really powerful mantra. Or it can be just if you're into metta, just metta or loving kindness. Or if you want like peace, you say to yourself, peace. Or if you've got a sense of humour like me, one of my favourite mantras is if you breathe in, shut, breathe out, up. You say that to yourself quite a few times. Now the point is with a mantra that you have to listen after you say the word or the group of words, to pause to find its meaning. Now that has a couple of benefits, because if you pause for its meaning, these mantras, they should be something which is interesting, so it's pointing to something which grabs the mind's attention, and it's pointing to the reality of that mantra beyond the words. So sunyata, sunyata, what does it actually mean? sunyata, or emptiness, functions as a signpost, as a pointer. And if you say it to yourself enough times, eventually the mind's going to look in that direction. It will look at sunyata. And the first, after a while, you'll actually see sunyata, emptiness. Only for a few moments, though, and the mind will pause there. Because when the mind's interested in something, it doesn't need to say anything. And you're experiencing that emptiness for a few seconds, but you're also experiencing silence beyond the mantra. And then the emptiness disappears again. You have to say the mantra again, emptiness. Emptiness. But every time you say it and you pause to look where it's directing you, it should happen naturally. You linger longer and longer on where that mantra is pointing to, on silence, emptiness, or love, or peace, wherever it is. And that's where you start to experience what, you know, I say is like the gap between thoughts, the silence. And it's not just any old silence. You're choosing one of the beautiful mental objects. So there's the perception of emptiness, or the perception of like metta, or the perception of peace. These are really great sort of mantras to do, because they are conducive to the arising of silence. However, to go into a jhana on these things, that you have to just completely let go of the saying and go completely to the meaning. So if it's peace, you have peace right in front of your mind, and that peacefulness just blows up into a beautiful nimitta. It's a joyful mental object of peacefulness. Of it's like emptiness. Emptiness becomes so profound that you dive right into it, and you are emptiness, and you're blissing out on emptiness. So that's how you get into a jhana, using a mantra as one of your vehicles. It's interesting, in the suttas the Buddha gives, not just the Buddha, many times you have this series, oh well, not a series, like a story or a description of like the king going to visit the Buddha. And they always say that the king goes in his carriage as far as the carriage can go, and then he gets out of his carriage and goes by foot as far as he can walk, and then he comes to the hall where the Buddha is sitting with the monks, and then he takes off his shoes and enters the hall, and then he's right in front of the Buddha. It's a beautiful like metaphor, because if you're doing mantra, it's like getting into a carriage. You go in the carriage as far as the carriage can take you. Then you've got to get out of the carriage, because you can't drive your car right close to your zafu. You've got to leave it in the car park, and then you've got to walk into here, and then you leave your shoes outside, and then you can come and walk in. So the mantra is like the carriage. It takes you so far, then you've got to get out of the carriage and then walk. Just go to the meaning of this. And then you've got to, that takes you to the hall where the Buddha lives, to the world of jhanas. But then you've got to take something off, your shoes, to actually enter that hall. And you know what those shoes are in this metaphor? The dua and the body. Those are the things you have to take off and leave outside the hall. But to do that, you've got to go as far, you've got to get a carriage first of all, to go from the city to the Jeta Grove where the Buddha is staying. And you've got to get out of the carriage and walk through the forest and then take off your shoes. So each of these meditation objects and methods is like a vehicle which will take you so far. And the closer you get to the Buddha, the more refined the vehicle has to become. So that's how we can use mantras to get into jhanas. Use it as one of the vehicles. Is it good to do a mantra while doing anapanasati instead of counting? Yeah, there's that very traditional method of doing buddho with the breath, breathing in bud, breathing out to, bud, to, bud, to. Especially if you have a feeling for that word. It's very powerful in northeast Thailand, because being a Buddhist country, people are brought up with so much faith and confidence in the Buddha. And just the very sound of that word is impregnated with power. And so for a northeast Thai, doing that chant, or the internal mantra with the breath is very, very powerful indeed. So you can choose a mantra if it's the Buddha or the Dhamma or the Sangha, or if it's like peace or sunyata, or you can get your own mantra up. But a good mantra is that which has within it some sort of like powerful, awesome feeling for you. Something which, you know, you want to say over and over and over again. Something which, you know, you really sort of find its meaning is very profound and beautiful. And that's where the mantra can lead you to deep meditation. So if you've had trouble with your meditation, or if like during the day that one of the meditations is difficult, try doing a bit of mantra work and see how that goes. And you find it sort of encourages the mind, it gives it something to work on, gives it something a bit more tangible than just watching the breath or watching the present moment. And it's a very marvellous way of meditating. Okay, next question. Last night during question time, I think mention was made of the need to balance samatha with energy and equanimity practice. Could you say something more about what equanimity actually is, and how it supports samatha and virya energy, and how to cultivate equanimity? Now, equanimity in Pali is called upeka. It literally means just looking on. And it's a very beautiful little simile there, just looking on at what's going on. Not choosing what you're going to see, not doing anything about it, just looking on. It's the attitude you have when you're in a plane, going on your holiday, looking through the window. You know you can't do anything, because you're not the captain of the aeroplane. Even if you go and tell the captain to do a loop-de-loop, or just to go and go left or go right, unless you're a hijacker with a gun, they're not going to do what you tell them to. You've got no control at all. All you can do is just look on. You're a passenger. Equanimity is like that. You're being a passenger in the moment rather than the doer. And equanimity is also not judging. It's just looking on, not forming an opinion about what you're doing, whether it's good or whether it's bad. It just looks on. It doesn't judge. This attitude of our mind, which is always assessing good or bad, useful, not useful, just completely let go of that mind which is always assessing. Because when you're assessing, it has all sorts of consequences. If you assess it as useful, you've got to sort of try and keep hold of it, to try and gain it, possess it. If it's something which you assess as being a problem, you have to try and get rid of it. It just creates too much business. So in equanimity, we just look on, passively, almost with indifference to whatever we're experiencing. We're actually resting the mind. I usually do it just by doing letting be meditation. Okay, just go and sit down and do nothing. I'm not trying to watch the breath. I'm not trying to get into jhana. Sit down, let go. See what happens. It's always a see what happens sort of meditation, without trying to direct it, without trying to steer it at all. That's equanimity. So you're at peace with whatever you're experiencing. You're equanimous. Whether you've got an ache or pain, whether you're tired, whether you've got full of energy, whether you're sitting outside or laying on your bed, pretty equanimity. Whatever's happening now is just fine. You're just a passenger. That's what equanimity, and how it supports samatha and virya. Equanimity is resting. And sometimes that so we only have a certain amount of energy of virya. And if we don't rest, then we get burnt out, which is so important in this meditation retreat, because you're doing much more meditation than you normally do. And if you can so easily burn out by the late afternoon, you've just done too much. You force yourself, you push yourself so far that something rebels inside of you. That's it, says the mind, no more meditation. You put me on that chair again and I'm going to teach you a lesson. And that's what happens, the rebellious inside. It's probably already happened quite a few times. the rebellious mind. So I call that the donkey mind sometimes. After a while, the donkey says, right, that's it, I'm not moving. And you try and pull a donkey. And the donkey's really smart and just how to keep still and how to resist. And so what you do is equanimity. Okay, donkey, you can have a rest. Just stay where you are, I'm not going to pull you at all. Here's a carrot. Enjoy yourself. It's equanimity. You have to do that to yourself every now and again in this meditation retreat. I told a few people in the interviews, it gets really tough and you're really having a hard time, go into your room and have a snooze. Have half an hour in the bed. And just lay down and have a nice afternoon nap without feeling guilty about it. You get up afterwards and you find because that you've given yourself a break, you get up afterwards and the next time you meditate, beautiful meditation. In the monastery I call it throwing the dog a bone. I think I mentioned that last night. Throw the dog a bone now and again. The defilements. Just give them something to chew on for half an hour. And then they're quite happy, then they allow you to meditate for the next hour or two and they don't cause you any trouble at all. You don't realise, they don't realise this is a way of actually getting on top of them eventually. So this is how equanimity can cultivate virya, because you're overcoming the donkey mind, which is the opposite of virya, of energy. And the samatha, where you actually can develop these beautiful states of mind, it does take some energy. It does take some softness of the mind. If you've got a very hard mind, and you've developed a hard mind, you're just going into meditation like a US Marine, you find you can never actually develop deep meditation. You have to have that softness, that joyfulness, that playfulness. And then you develop beautiful meditation. And just as a basic rule, some of the monks who tell the best jokes in Thailand, they've got the best meditation. Just because, no, it's only a generalization. Because they're light-hearted and they're sort of easygoing, they're fun-loving. Some of the best monks are the best fun-loving people I've ever met. And because of that attitude, that softness of the mind, they can get into deep meditation. And there's a connection there which is important to point out. You're willing to have happiness. You're soft. The mind is easy just to turn towards the joy inside. And you're able to allow that joy to really grow. So equanimity, like through resting the mind, giving it a break, you find that you're feeding it happiness. You're feeding it some joy. And if it gets frustrated because it's always trying to samatha, you just let it go for a little while and then it's more willing to be samatted afterwards. So that's the way I think it works in my experience anyway. Sometimes in my experience, you know, sometimes you really work hard sort of trying to calm the mind down. We've always got at our monastery, those of us who have stayed there, we've got the secret shelf in the library of Calvin and Hobbes books. And it's amazing sometimes that if you're really working hard in meditation, you go up there and just read Calvin and Hobbes for a quarter of an hour and you go back and your mind is really great afterwards. You throw the dog a bone and that quarter of an hour is well spent and you get into deep meditation afterwards. So I don't know, maybe the next retreat on the advice to guests, and not, they should bring their torch, their their blankets and bedding and Calvin Hobbes books for times when they get too tight and they need a bit of a rest. Can you please talk about the four immaterial jhanas and the importance in obtaining enlightenment? And those immaterial jhanas are interesting in the sense that a little bit of a controversy amongst monks, because if you look at the story of the life of the Buddha, that he seems that when he was a child, he was sitting under a rose apple tree, and almost automatically, without really knowing what he was doing, attained to the first jhana. And it was a very pleasant experience as a young boy for him. But then when he left home and became a wandering ascetic, that he did all sorts of other austere practices, and also he did the two immaterial jhanas, the third and the fourth immaterial jhana, and then finding that the ascetic practices and those two types of immaterial jhanas wasn't bringing him to enlightenment, then he sat under, well, actually just I got that a little bit confused. He did the two immaterial jhanas first, and then finding that that did not satisfy him, he did the ascetic practices, and finding that did not satisfy him, then decided to have a bathe, have some proper food, and thinking that going back to his childhood experience of the first jhana might be the way to become enlightened. And obviously it was. And the point of that story, it did seem that from the time the Buddha sat under the rose apple tree as a boy until the time he sat under the Bodhi tree on the night of his enlightenment, the implication is very strong that he didn't do any jhanas at all, not the first jhana, or second, or third, and fourth jhana, but he did do the immaterial jhanas. And it does seem to be that the immaterial jhanas can be accessed without going through the material jhanas. However, traditionally it says that you should do the four material jhanas first and then do the immaterial jhanas, saying the immaterial jhanas are indeed based on the fourth jhana. However that may be is still uncertain in my mind. That the texts usually do say that there is two ways you can become fully enlightened, and those two ways, this is in the Kitagiri Sutta, for those of you who want to check this one out in the Majjhima Nikaya, the two ways are with the four rupa jhanas, or at least one of them, but no immaterial jhanas, or with the four rupa jhanas and the immaterial jhanas. There's no way of getting around at least one of the jhanas. The immaterial jhanas aren't always necessary. If a person does have those abilities in jhanas and decides to develop the immaterial jhanas, first of the immaterial jhanas is the infinity of space, where you take that as your concept and you sustain your attention on it without moving, until that becomes the one and only thing that you are aware of, without moving, with equanimity, with pure mindfulness. That's what you are in. What's in your mind? There's no feeling in the body. There's no sound. The five senses have completely disappeared. This is like the mind taking the object of the concept of infinity of space. And the next immaterial jhana is the mind taking the concept of the infinity of consciousness, and that's what it takes as this object, and it maintains that attention, that awareness on that object unmoving for a long, long period of time. The third immaterial jhana is where the mind takes as its concept, as its object, with the other five senses completely quietened down and subdued, so they're not active at all. The mind takes like nothingness, nothingness, emptiness, as its object of meditation. And the fourth immaterial jhana is where even that one is let go of, and one takes as a concept, or this object, which can only be described as neither perception nor non-perception. You almost switched off the consciousness, but not quite. And the stage which comes after that is not really called an immaterial jhana or a material jhana, because it's a state of cessation of consciousness, of feeling and perception, where the mind stops and ceases. And that's usually the purpose of the immaterial jhanas, is to give the stage by stage way of ceasing consciousness. And in all these material jhanas and immaterial jhanas, it's always in the Pali, the way it's described is you experience these jhanas. And you experience the stage of neither perception or non-perception. It's a conscious experience, even a very refined one. But when it comes down to the cessation, the verb changes, the word changes, you touch it, pusati, and then you disappear. And consciousness stops. And you're still, really still. This is a cessation of experience. You're not conscious in this state. You're not perceiving in this state. There's no Vedana of any of the senses. All of the senses have stopped. And after you remain in that state for however long you remain there, then you touch as you come out. It's as if that you go into the door, so you know there's a door there, but on the other side is complete cessation. And the reason for doing that is like refining each of these stages of concentration or stages of sustained awareness, because each one is more profound, more blissful than the preceding one. The infinity of space is more blissful as a concept, is more profound than the ordinary fourth jhana. The infinity of consciousness is more profound, is more peaceful, more subtle than the infinity of space. The nothingness is even more refined, more profound, more peaceful, more subtle than the infinity of consciousness. And this state, which is described as neither perception nor non-perception, is more refined, more peaceful, more blissful than the state of nothingness. And when you experience the stage of cessation, you realize that even that stage of neither perception nor non-perception is like an irritation of consciousness. You find that even the most refined type of consciousness, mental consciousness, which can be experienced by a human being, even that, you understand, is an irritation. This dukkha. And this is where you understand from that experience that all conditioned things, all types of consciousness, all types of perception, all activity of the senses, the six senses, comes under the sway of an irritation of dukkha. And then you fully see in the Four Noble Truths. Also, you see not just the cessation of the doer in the first jhana, you see the cessation of the knower as well. Consciousness actually ceases, stops completely, and you see it arising again. When you see this, then you know that the consciousness, the knower, can't be yourself. You know it is anicca. It ceases. It ends. And the experience of cessation automatically has to give the experience of the attainment of at least non-returner, anagami, or arahat. There's no need to do vipassana. There's no need to sort of go and think deliberately about anicca, dukkha, anatta. These stages are so refined and powerful, you cannot miss it. You have to either attain to be an arahat or to be an anagami. Those are the only two possibilities if you enter that state and you emerge afterwards. So that's why it is a way towards enlightenment, by using this calming of the mind down to everything is calmed down, everything stops. When you find out that everything stops, it's as if you can see, you can stop this illusion of self as well, and it completely disappears. And afterwards you know about the teaching of anatta, you know about anicca, you know about dukkha, because you've experienced it to its limit. The only reason why not an arahat is because you're still delighting in that state. delighting in cessation, which is just that little bit of attachment, which is a difference between a full arahat and the anagami non-returner. However, those are really refined states, which take really refined meditation. And again, in this retreat, we're aiming for the first jhana. Okay, this is a good point. The four immaterial jhanas and the four material jhanas, all these jhanas were known, whether they were well known or not is a debatable question, but at least they were known. And why is it that some of those teachers or those people practicing these things never attained to the enlightenment which the Buddha attained to? And again, the reason is that that degree of quietness, samatha, will certainly give you a lot of wisdom. But the illusion of self, which is the crux of this whole process of liberation, is such a strange thing. It goes completely against the grain for many people, unless you've had it suggested to you again and again and again and again, that just getting into these stages doesn't guarantee that you'll see non-self. In fact, that it doesn't really help at all unless someone has suggested the very possibility and has described these stages as not sort of higher selves, but just as aspects of the consciousness. It is because that, say, in the Christianity, that some of the Christian monks would attain to jhanas, but without the framework of in which to understand these experiences, that straight away they would misunderstand these and take these things as being experience of God. If you do experience these stages, then you know that it's so easy to have, if you didn't really have these things explained to you, to mistake some of these jhana experiences, especially like a first jhana, because the doer has gone, but it's as if you're not there anymore. It's a huge part of that which you take to be you, a self, goes in first jhana, and it's called the doer. But it's bliss, and it's a very powerful experience. And so often, you can understand how if you came from a religion or a culture which had God very central to its teaching and philosophy, straight away you say, I'm gone, here is something very powerful and very beautiful and very still and awesome, this must be God. And whether it's in Hinduism or Christianity, so often people experience the first jhana as soon as this union with the divine, union with God. And I think I did mention somewhere or other that when I was on this last retreat, teaching retreat in Sydney, with one of the meditators there, he'd been in a group called the Siddha Yoga before. It was a Hindu tradition whose leader at that time was Muktananda, who was like a very well-known teacher in India, and had many disciples. And he was telling me that while he was meditating with that group, he did get a very beautiful nimitta, a very image of a beautiful blue pearl against a turquoise background. And when he told his teacher said, if you can absorb into that, then that's enlightenment. And all of you, you've heard me talking long enough now, that if you absorb into that, a dinky dynamita, that is first jhana, not enlightenment. And he was actually quite fascinated to hear me talk like this, to see how the same experience can be interpreted in completely different ways by different traditions. And this is the reason why a person who would attain to these jhanas or these immaterial jhanas, before the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, would so easily misinterpret these as not evidence of the cessation of a self, but the evidence of like a higher self or a cosmic consciousness or a God or something which they are attaining to. So it's, as I said a couple of days ago, it's only when you have things like jhana together with a basis in the knowledge of the Buddha's teachings, a suggestion straight from the Buddha's mouth or from an Arya, that there is no self, that this, even this experience of jhana, look what has ceased, look what has gone. Afterwards, look what's there. And to see that even those jhanas are impermanent, to see the non-self in those as well, to see what has ceased, what has gone, what is left behind. And so only when you look at the jhanas with a certain perspective can they lead to enlightenment. And that's why I said that the five factors which support the arising of the stream entry, the first stage of enlightenment, are virtue, knowledge of the Buddha's teachings, discussion of those teachings, samatha vipassana, the meditation practice.